Congress is going hard after TikTok. Some ask, why TikTok?
The government is overdoing it and going from protecting America to provoking.
The question, just how big of a threat does China represent? I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, the crescent moon marks the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. But what if you can't actually see the moon?
Astronomers have been struggling for the millennium to try to figure that out.
Plus, it's cherry blossom season in Japan, an eagerly anticipated time.
Always waiting. When is the full bloom? When is the full bloom?
They've been tracking that bloom for centuries. The records tell us a lot about climate change. And Mexico's challenge to the Panama Canal. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Biden has been up north today, speaking with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. They're discussing a new deal to help Canada limit migration from the United States. Tens of thousands of people from Central America and beyond sought asylum in Canada last year after crossing through the U.S. That could soon change. Susan Fratsky with the Migration Policy Institute has been following this. She's in Washington. Susan, we're talking about people crossing into Canada illegally from the United States. Who are they and where are they coming from?
Well, it's quite a diverse group of people. At the moment, there's quite a few people from Nigeria and from Haiti crossing over, but also individuals from Iraq, from Pakistan, from a number of different places. You know, some have come into the U.S. with Canada as a destination, but there are also others who have been here for a while on various forms of temporary status and have just become frustrated with the state of the asylum system or the U.S. immigration system and have chosen to try their luck in Canada. So it's really a diverse flow of people.
For those who have arrived more recently, why are they going to Canada rather than seeking asylum here in the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. asylum system is incredibly backlogged. At the moment when people enter to apply for asylum, it can take years to actually get a hearing on their asylum claim. In the meantime, they are here on temporary status with very limited rights and limited ability to access a green card or some form of long-term residency. So it's both a lack of hope of actually getting their asylum claims heard in a timely fashion, and for others, a sort of, you know, lack of options to actually regularize their status and stay in the U.S. long term.
Now, the image that a lot of us have at this point is of migrants in northern New York on a place called Roxham Road crossing into Quebec. And I know this new deal is to amend this safe third country agreement that exists between the U.S. and Canada. What is the current agreement?
The current agreement is one that was concluded back in 2002, and it made it essentially impossible for an individual to cross from the U.S. to Canada or vice versa to claim asylum if they crossed at an official entry point, an official port of entry. But it did still allow people to cross between ports of entry to claim asylum without the risk of being returned. And this is why people have been crossing from Roxham Road, because it's not an official entry point.
So what are the changes to this agreement?
The new agreement will make it apply in between official crossing points. So if someone like at Roxham Road crosses the border without going through a official border guard station where they have to present paperwork, but just crosses of their own volition, they would still then fall under the confines of the agreement as long as they make an asylum claim within the first 14 days of crossing the border. So say someone crosses at Roxham Road, they are apprehended by the Canadian authorities, file an asylum claim within that first 2-week period after they're apprehended for crossing the border, they could be returned to the United States and be deemed ineligible for asylum in Canada.
So how big of a deal is this change?
It's quite significant on the Canadian side. As you said, there's been tens of thousands of people crossing within the last couple of years to make asylum claims. And this has become a major political issue in Canada, particularly in Quebec, where most of the people have been going. The premier of Quebec has been very outspoken about the fact that they would like to see this issue addressed by the Canadian government. And it became a major issue that Justin Trudeau himself has been taking up and had promised to address with Biden. So achieving this agreement is fairly significant politically directly for the Canadian side.
But there's another part of this agreement, as I understand it, which is that Canada will take, I think, up to 15,000 migrants if they apply through official channels. Flesh that out for us. What does that mean?
The trade-off that was made as part of renegotiating this deal appears to be that Canada will offer these additional 15,000 places. This is part of the broader approach that the United States has been pushing towards addressing migration within North America and the broader region as a whole, which is to build more legal pathways for people to move and discourage unauthorized migration. This is behind the entry programs that were announced in the last couple of months for Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, Haitians, and Cubans. And it appears that this is the same lens that's been brought to this new agreement with Canada.
Susan Fratsky is a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. She's been helping us understand an update to an agreement between the U.S. and Canadian governments that would restrict certain migrants from seeking protections in Canada. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mexico is hard at work on a huge development project. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says it will rival the Panama Canal. It won't be another waterway, though. The interoceanic corridor will connect ports on the Atlantic and Pacific coasts of Mexico. From southern Mexico, Michael Fox has the story.
This is how U.S. climate envoy John Kerry was welcomed in Mexico this week, with an official ceremony honoring the birth of Mexico's first indigenous president, Benito Juárez, more than two centuries ago.
So today we celebrate leadership.
Hoy celebramos el liderazgo.
We celebrate the beginning of independence.
Celebramos
for Mexico,
el principio de la independencia para México.
And we celebrate together Estados Unidos, México, para siempre. Thank you.
U.S., Mexico, forever, he said. But there was another reason Kerry was visiting here in the Mexican state of Oaxaca. See, this is the location of the new interoceanic corridor. It's the signature project of President López Obrador. With a price tag of at least $1 billion, this ambitious effort includes modernizing ports and airports, building 200 miles of new railways, highways, an oil pipeline, a fiber optic network, and 10 industrial parks. López Obrador is hoping to attract U.S. investment, especially for new wind farms here in Oaxaca. And John Kerry this week signaled that the Biden administration is on board. But there's a problem.
No al corredor interoceánico. No.
Indigenous groups are not happy about López Obrador's interoceanic development project. This group of community residents blocked a major highway in the region just ahead of Kerry's visit. Others marched on the capital of Oaxaca and occupied the main plaza on Monday.
No permitamos que nos despojen y violenten nuestros derechos.
We won't let you remove us from our lands and violate our rights, said an indigenous leader in this video shared on social media. In the video, he stands with a group of protesters in front of a rail line that should be under construction, but they've been blocking it now for nearly a month. Carlos Bellas Torres is one of the leaders of Usizoni, one of the leading indigenous groups battling the development project.
Primero es una imposición, pues, del gobierno mexicano en territorios indígenas donde la población no fue consultada.
The Mexican government is imposing this project on indigenous territories. The population was not consulted, he says. They're removing people from their land. But officials say this project is a win-win.
Ahora Oaxaca se va a convertir en el nuevo.
Oaxacan Governor Salomón Jara Cruz said earlier this month that the interoceanic corridor would transform Oaxaca. We will be a geopolitical and strategic point for global commerce, he said. Experts say the corridor could create hundreds of thousands of new jobs.
Vamos a entregar subsidios fiscales. El que invierta ahí no va a pagar.
President López Obrador says he's going to encourage foreign companies to set up in the region. He says there will be state subsidies and plenty of jobs. The indigenous town of Juchitán is along the development corridor. Martín Esteban Martínez drives a mototaxi here, but he's also in his final years of a degree in electrical engineering. He's concerned about what this huge development project could mean for the region's indigenous culture.
Como desarrollo estatal se ve bien debido a que bajamos los índices de inmigración de estudiantes.
At the same time, he says, it could be really positive for Oaxaca. Many new companies are going to come here, so that would be an opportunity. But there's still a long way to go. Beyond the state infrastructure, private companies have yet to commit, and indigenous communities have promised to continue to fight. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Across the globe, nearly 2 billion Muslims are observing the holy month of Ramadan. The sighting of a crescent moon marks the beginning of the event. The timing shifts each year. But what happens when you can't actually see the moon? And who gets to make the call on when Ramadan actually starts? Here to answer some of our questions is Rizwan Arastu, a Muslim scholar, author, and the founder of IslamicLiteracy.org. Rizwan, astronomy plays a big part in helping determine the official start of the fast for Ramadan. Can you explain why this moon sighting is so important to the religious holiday?
Like with all things, Muslims look to the Quran and the traditions of their prophet to figure out how to live their lives. And we have teachings from Prophet Muhammad that say that we should start each month and end each month with the sighting of the crescent. Based on that commandment, then we have tried to figure out how we can predict it when we can't see it. And so astronomers have been struggling for the millennium to try to figure that out.
So do you have to see the moon with the naked eye in your own town or region or country for Ramadan to officially start?
We have a system of law that tells us how to implement these requirements. And so some of our jurists will say that you have to see it with the naked eye. Some will say that you could use modern implements like telescopes. And then some say you can use calculations. And if you can predict when that crescent will be visible, then that's good enough. You don't have to actually see it at all.
Do you look for it with the naked eye yourself, or do you use modern technology?
So I'm a Shi'i Muslim. And typically the Shia, their scholars tell them that they do have to look at it with the naked eye. So yes, we go out and we usually have, you know, community or family go out and look. And, you know, all across the globe, there are people looking for the moon. But you might say, look, like, the sky sometimes is cloudy and you can't see it. We're able to use calculations to help us to predict whether it'll be seen or not. And so even if, you know, in Chicago, it's cloudy on the horizon and I can't see it, but there are neighboring cities that are able to see it, then their sighting helps me to know that I could have seen it as well. And I can start the new month.
Yeah, I was asking because, of course, these days we have all sorts of technology that can let you know when there is a crescent moon lurking behind those clouds.
That is true, but it's not quite accurate yet because the technology, the science has not yet gotten to the point where we can predict it with certainty. And it's not like the new moon. So the new moon is a momentary phenomenon that we can predict exactly when it's going to happen. The crescent is actually something, it's about a day to 2 days after the new moon when the angle between the sun and the moon gets to a certain point, you can see a little sliver. That sliver has to be big enough that we can see it, bright enough that we can see it, far enough away from the angle of the sun so the sun's not washing it out. There are too many factors, and at least until now, astronomers haven't been able to get a handle on all those factors to be able to predict with certainty.
This year, a Muslim astronaut is in space during Ramadan. He's not the first Muslim to head to space, but I'm curious, with an odd sense of time and light, how would he be able to go about praying up in space and make sure that he's facing Mecca?
We have similar situations for people who live in extreme northern areas. Each jurist will come up with a way to work around the lack of kind of proper 24-hour day and night cycles. The Qibla, which is what we call the direction of the Kaaba, we can imagine kind of a pole extending up from the Kaaba and Mecca all the way into space. And wherever you are on Earth, you would face that pole. So even if you were in a plane, for instance, flying, you know, 30,000 feet in the air, though the Kaaba is only maybe 30, 40 feet high, you would still pray in that direction of that pole that's extending up from the Kaaba. And if you extend that logic, you could say the person in the space station could kind of look down to Earth and see what time zone he's in and pray at the time of the people down there. And then he would face in the direction where that pole would be extending up from the Kaaba into space.
Rizwan Arastu is a Muslim scholar and author. We've been talking to him about moon sighting and Ramadan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's cherry blossom season in Japan, a time when people walk, picnic, and take many photos beneath the blossoms. In Kyoto, the flowers are just about in full peak bloom. As the climate warms, the peaks have been shifting earlier and earlier in the year. Japan's fascination with the cherry blossom has provided a window into climate change. The World's Carolyn Beeler first reported on this 2 years ago when Kyoto's blooms peaked on their earliest date since records began in the 9th century.
Cherry blossom season starts with the first smell of spring, at least according to Nozomi Uematsu.
We are always anticipating this kind of moment of cherry blossom.
She remembers as a kid growing up outside of Tokyo, watching the first buds start to emerge.
Always waiting. When is the full bloom? When is the full bloom?
Japanese newspapers print official forecasts. YouTubers explain how to plan the best picnic under the white and pink branches.
Hey guys, today we are in Ueno, and we are going to show you how to have the best hanami experience in Japan. Let's go!
This fascination dates back centuries. Uematsu is now a Japanese studies lecturer at the UK's University of Sheffield and says mentions of watching cherry blossoms in Japanese poetry date back to the 8th century.
Around that time, really, aristocrat really started planting the cherry blossom and then having a party, including reading poetry.
Diaries and chronicles written by emperors, aristocrats, governors, and monks in Kyoto provide a surprisingly complete look at when cherry blossoms have flowered over the past 1,200 years. Yasuyuki Eono, a scientist at Osaka Prefecture University, has tracked the dates that blossoms hit their peak bloom back to the year 812 using those written records. Since about 1800, the data suggest full flowering dates have gradually been moving earlier. Tracking when and how plants and animals change with the seasons is called phenology. Teresa Crimmins is the director of the USA National Phenology Network.
So phenology is this funky, old-fashioned word for a phenomenon that we are all really quite familiar with.
Written records of everything from grape harvests in Europe to the arrival of migratory birds in North America help scientists piece together the phenological record. As global temperatures rise, many spring things are happening earlier and fall things are happening later. But these changes aren't happening in sync. A classic example, a flower might bloom earlier in a warmer year, but the bee that pollinates it might be on the same old schedule.
And when that occurs, when we have years where things don't line up, there's losers all around. The plants that depend on the pollination service don't necessarily get it. And the pollinators that are depending on those flowers as a food source can suffer as well.
For most species, scientists don't have the long phenological record they do for Kyoto's cherry blossoms. So they're just starting to get a sense of how relationships are changing between paired species, like plants and their pollinators, or migratory birds and what they eat during stopovers. Who knows, maybe evidence from today's YouTube videos will help scientists tackling those kinds of questions 1,200 years from now. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
This concept of phenological mismatch can be found in a lot of places in nature around the world. And with climate change, the timing is increasingly off. To dig into more examples, we turn to Richard Primack. He's a plant ecologist at Boston University. Richard, what are some of your favorite examples of phenological mismatch from around the world?
Well, of course, I really favor the example of our own research group, which is based in Concord, Massachusetts. We're looking at the records of Henry David Thoreau, his observations of natural history from the 1850s, and seeing how things have changed up into the present time. And what we see there is that the trees and the wildflowers are changing very rapidly in response to a warming climate, but that the birds are not changing as rapidly. And so there's a possibility of a mismatch between the plants and the birds, and what connects them is the insects. And the insects are also responding very rapidly to climate change. So it's possible that when the birds arrive in the spring from their overwintering places in the southeastern United States or the tropics, that they're really not going to be able to find as many insects to feed on for themselves and also to feed to their nestlings.
What are some other examples you're seeing?
Well, a very famous example, which has received a lot of attention, is that in the Netherlands, wildlife ecologists have observed pied flycatchers, a migratory bird species, is not changing its arrival time in the Netherlands based on a warming climate at all. But the caterpillars that it feeds on are responding very strongly to climate change, as are the oak trees on which the caterpillars feed. And so when the pied flycatcher arrives in the Netherlands, it's missing the big peak of caterpillar abundance that it really needs to feed both for itself and also to feed to its nestlings. And as a result of this phenological mismatch in the Netherlands, pied flycatcher populations are declining. So this is a very clear example of a phenological mismatch which is harming a particular species.
Now, should we expect with climate change that these mismatches are just going to get more and more frequent and more intense?
Yes. The reason that we're having these phenological mismatches is that species have different ways of responding to a change in climate. Some respond to temperature, some respond to photoperiod, some respond to precipitation. And so with a changing climate, species respond in different ways. And for some species, that provides advantages. And for other species, it really harms them. So what we're going to see is a flux in populations of many species, and in particularly for many endangered species, this might lead to them declining quite precipitously and even going extinct.
In some ways, could this just be another episode of evolution that some species will survive, some won't, and maybe there may be new species come on board to adapt to this, or is that just too Pollyannish?
Yes, I think that's not a realistic view. I think that these changes are happening so rapidly that it's, for most species, they won't really be able to adapt to it. I mean, there will be some species that have very short life cycles, like certain insect species, certain short-lived bird species, annual plants, that can adapt. But for longer-lived species, like long-lived mammals, trees, I think that these changes are too rapid for evolution to really be a factor. And also that for particular species that are already in danger of extinction because their habitats have been damaged by other kinds of human activity, climate change is one more threat to their populations and might be the factor which drives them to extinction.
So besides getting climate change under control, is there anything humans can do in the here and now to help?
Yes. So what we can do is we can recognize that many species are very vulnerable to a change in climate. And so a lot of the things that we can do in general for conservation take on even more urgency with climate change. So, for example, people planting pollinator gardens to provide additional resources to pollinators, or planting plant species that have fleshy fruits to support birds during their autumn migration. So these are all things that we can do. So things that we're already doing to support rare and endangered species take on even greater urgency with climate change and with this potential for phenological mismatch.
Richard Premack is a plant ecologist at Boston University. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. A book reveals a painful chapter in a family's history, and a granddaughter confronts her grandfather's past.
Oh my God, he was a soldier for Hitler in Germany. This was his life. And I had no idea. He was just the guy who gave me gummy bears because he had a candy store in the basement.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Yesterday in Washington, members of Congress sounded off at the CEO of TikTok. Here's a taste of the action on Capitol Hill.
To the American people watching today, hear this. TikTok is a weapon by the Chinese Communist Party to spy on you, manipulate what you see, and exploit for future generations.
That's Republican Kathy McMorris, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Yesterday was just the latest round in an ongoing battle between the U.S. and China. The two superpowers have been squaring off economically, diplomatically, and trying to outflex the other militarily. But here's a question. Is the U.S. overestimating the threat that China poses? We reached out to David Kang to help address that. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. I asked him if the threat from TikTok is really that great, or was yesterday in Congress an overreaction?
All companies engage in surveillance or capturing your data. And so to that extent, looking at what TikTok is doing is fine. What is being overlooked, though, is that all the American companies take the data and sell it and do the same kinds of things. And we're not necessarily any more secure if we just get rid of TikTok.
So why the focus on TikTok as opposed to other social media apps?
Precisely because it's Chinese. What's happened in the last 5 years or so is that an overwhelming consensus has begun to emerge in D.C. about a China threat across, as you mentioned, diplomatic, economic, everything. And so it is very popular now, and it's been especially popular in this new Congress, to beat up on China and to make performative claims about how dangerous it is. There's definitely competition with China. But in many ways, I think the United States, and particularly the government, is overdoing it and going from protecting America to provoking.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, are we creating a feedback loop, essentially? I mean, escalating a situation that may not really exist.
In the larger realm of U.S.-China relations, the attempt to decouple our economies in many ways is measurably harming Americans. Our prices are higher. We're having less trade. But in order to show that we're going to contain China, we're engaging in this. And in many ways, it's not helping Americans.
What's your assessment of the actual risk China poses to the U.S. through its technology and its friendship with Russia and its increasing dominance in the Pacific region, taking them all together?
There's definitely questions about what China is doing. It's an authoritarian country, and its leader Xi Jinping has been consolidating power at home. And it is no longer nearly as willing to be quiet about its power and its influence. That's something the United States has to deal with. That said, it doesn't appear that China has any intention to like conquer and take over the U.S. and things like this. I mean, the claims that we have about expansive Chinese aims are in many ways exaggerated.
Okay, well, let's just take one or two of these issues where China seems to be a threat. Okay, strengthening ties in the Middle East, Africa, the islands of the Pacific. Does China pose an actual threat in any of those places?
Not to the United States. We tend to think it's a threat because we're used to being in charge. But for example, the recent peace deal brokered by China in the Middle East, basically pretty good for everyone, especially if the United States doesn't have to do it. We are competing with China for influence in Africa or around the Pacific Islands, but that's not a threat. When we talk about a threat, is it a threat to the existence of the United States or even the prosperity? That's not clear at all.
But what about simply geostrategic, who has the influence, who are these countries going to talk to and rely on? Isn't that an issue in and of itself?
Well, this is where we get power for the sake of power, influence for the sake of influence. If we have this goal, as you said, we must be the most influential. But that's not necessarily clear why we should. What does that mean for the United States other than we need to be number one? And there I wish we had more discussion about what does the U.S. want? What is actually at stake other than who's the top dog in the world?
So where do we go from here? How do we de-escalate the situation?
I'm actually a little pessimistic in the short to medium run because everyone in the United States, on the policymaking elites, is climbing on the let's attack China. It's a very convenient political move. So it's performative or rhetorical. I would like to see us begin to have a little bit less heated or excessive discussions about Chinese influence in the region and real discussions about what America should do diplomatically and economically. And I'll give you an example. The rest of the East Asian region is rapidly joining these economic trading partnerships in East Asia. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Plan. The United States is clearly not joining those. The region is moving towards integrating with China and with the United States. And we are not being a part of that game. And I'd like to see us be part of it.
If you don't think China is a real threat to the U.S., is there a country that you think is?
Not to the degree that we think any country is. Russia, China, none of these countries pose the threat that the Soviet Union did 50 years ago, where they truly did desire global dominance. So in terms of survival, America is one of the safest countries in the world. We're surrounded by two oceans and we have two friendly allies. We have two, you know, we only have two borders, land borders. In many ways, we could be using our influence and our values and things that are very attractive for really positive reasons. I don't think we need to find China as much of a threat as it is. It is definitely a country that we have different values with and that we are going to have some problems with. But I would wish that we would not exaggerate that threat. And that would make it actually easier for us to figure out a strategy to actually dealing with China.
David Kang is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. David, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Never forget is a refrain often used around the Holocaust, and it's a phrase that Germany especially has taken to heart. There, prominent memorials, major events, and a huge array of artistic efforts commemorate the victims of the genocide. But when it comes to Germans acknowledging Nazis in their own family, that conversation is often off limits. Our next report is from Alexa Dvorsen in Berlin. It's a personal story about how a single book helped unearth family secrets and gave rise to an unlikely friendship.
In the late 1990s, I took an assignment to write a book for a Holocaust education series that would expose young readers to true stories of people who were in their teens during the Nazi period and lived to tell about it. Some escaped deportation, others survived concentration camps, or helped liberate them as young Allied soldiers. My task was to profile a German who'd been in the Hitler Youth, the Nazis' vast network that groomed children to serve the brutal regime.
Ich weiß nur, dass ich mich arrangiert habe.
Edgar Gielsdorf, like millions of other German children, joined the organization after Adolf Hitler was named Chancellor in 1933. As an 8-year-old in the city of Cologne, Gielsdorf heard a steady stream of anti-Semitic propaganda, especially at school. It didn't square with his having a Jewish friend from an early age.
Wenn man mir gesagt hätte, du darfst auch nicht mehr mit einem Judenkind spielen.
I just came to terms with it all, he recalled. If I'd been officially forbidden to play with him, our friendship would certainly have ended. After conquering a stutter, Gielsdorf quickly rose through the ranks and became a Hitler Youth leader at 16, fully embracing Nazi ideals as if under a spell.
Ich bin niemals, aber wirklich niemals, einem Menschen begegnet.
His great regret, he told me, was that he'd never met anyone who opened his eyes to the reality of the Third Reich until after the war. It was only when he witnessed a death march as a wounded 20-year-old soldier that he realized he was marching toward madness, the title of my book. But before I got around to writing the manuscript, a history professor overseeing the project stopped me in my tracks. I know where your relatives were killed, she told me, and when. She'd recognized my last name from a book that mentioned every murdered family from one village or shtetl near her childhood home in Lithuania. In 1941, Nazis and their local helpers rounded up about 2 million Jews in the Baltics and the Soviet Union and shot them all in a series of massacres that came to be known as the Holocaust by Bullets. My grandfather's siblings and their extended families were among the dead, but I'd never heard this before. Little did I know that my book about the Hitler Youth would unlock another family secret more than 20 years after it was published.
Oh my goodness, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm so good. Thank you, Alexa, so much. Thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you so much.
I'm kind of speechless. I don't even know where to start, but first of all, you're welcome. And I'm so sorry about your mom's passing. I don't know.
Salama Aliyah had looked me up online. Before our phone call, she'd sent a Facebook message. I am Edgar Gielsdorf's granddaughter, she wrote. I pulled your book from a shelf after my mother died, and here I am.
Since you mentioned my mom, so it still feels like it was yesterday, we had a quite tumultuous relationship. I'm just going to jump through all my inhibitions and just talk to you like I've known you my whole life. Is that okay?
Salama lives in Chicago. Born in Beirut in 1978, she was a baby when her mother, Edgar Gielsdorf's daughter, brought her to Indiana, where Salama's Lebanese father was studying chemistry. She said she'd somehow sensed her grandfather's story all her life, even though no one ever addressed it.
Of course, nobody talked about it, because that is definitely something that our family is very good at, just not talking about stuff, which is why your book was so powerful. He had said something about his grandkids, and I was like, oh my God, that's me. That's my grandpa, and he's talking about me.
The U.S. publishers sent a copy of my book to Edgar Gielsdorf in 1999, 5 years before he died. It ended up in Salama's hands, but she was too preoccupied with her own trauma, which included child sexual abuse, to read it until 20 years later. Suddenly, a lot of things in her life made more sense.
Learning about him being so young and that deep manipulation of a young child. I know what that is.
In 1933, 7-year-old Edgar watched in horror as lawyers, judges, and district attorneys were violently rounded up by Nazi stormtroopers, shoved onto garbage trucks with metal grating, and driven away from the local courthouse. Listening to the grown-ups around him, Edgar learned all of the men were Jewish. But when he ran home in distress to tell his mother, she shrugged it off. Salama recognized a parallel with her own childhood.
When he was like, "Mom, Mom, this is going on," and she really just dismissed it or didn't engage it. And I thought, oh, crushing the vulnerability of a young child is like the worst thing that you can do. And that carried into my life.
This empathy for her grandfather clashes with her grief for all the lives lost in the Holocaust and her shame for her grandfather's role, a subject we discussed for hours when we finally met up in person.
My grandfather said, "When I think of the past, I really don't have feelings of guilt, but an enormous shame. I'm ashamed I was a part of it all, and I just didn't get it." And I read that, and I thought, oh my God, I am carrying that in my body. I can't explain it, and I'm sure there are people out there that would challenge me around this, and that's fine, they can do that, but there is a part in me that feels like I have done something so wrong and so horrible such that I'm carrying this as if it was mine.
That makes total sense.
Iris Wachsmuth, a Berlin-based sociologist, has studied what's referred to as the emotional inheritance in families of the Nazi perpetrator society across generations.
You have to deal with your feelings, you have to deal with the facts. And to come to that point to say, is that my story or is it from my grandparents? And to get that clear is a long process.
For years after the war, most Germans kept silent about the genocide. Researchers later identified several strategies families used to avoid feelings of guilt or responsibility, including suppression, denial, or a sense of heroism or victimhood. Wachsmuth says Edgar Gielsdorf was something of an outlier for people in his age group.
They didn't deal with their shame and guilt feelings. So in that way, I think he is an exception. Also, we know sometimes it's jumping over one generation and comes only into the third or fourth generation. But it's also typical that they have to deal with this deep, deep sadness that the first generation couldn't deal with.
How do you see Salama fitting into this bigger picture? Do you see her as an unusual example of someone who wants to really face everything?
Maybe it has to do with her own trauma. It has to do with all the silence in her family and this grandfather who is dealing in his way with truth. And that gives her a kind of power, I would say. It shows her resilience, but not everybody has that.
Lederhosen. Yeah, this is my opa.
Wow. In Chicago, Salama showed me family photographs recounting her childhood memories of trips to then West Germany to visit her grandfather, and I played part of my long ago conversation with him.
Ich hatte wiederum etwas angefangen, indem ich, wenn Sie so wollen, untertauchte.
He talked about going on the run to evade arrest by the occupying Allies just after the end of the war. But he realized he had to turn himself in and face the consequences. After a few months, I couldn't play that game anymore, he told me. I wasn't myself.
Weil ich nicht ich war.
How does it feel to hear his voice?
Well, I can remember it, the nuances of his voice, and I feel like I can see him. There's a part of me that was still protected and guarded that didn't want to know. And now hearing his voice, I'm super aware of a part of me that's like, oh my God, he was a soldier for Hitler in Germany. This was his life. Yeah. And I had no idea. He was just the guy who gave me gummy bears because he had a candy store in the basement.
Gielsdorf had written a book about his time in the Hitler Youth before we met, but he told me he'd never expressed his shame before our conversation. And that's what sticks with Salama.
There's a lot of perpetrators in my family on both sides, none of which showed up differently before they died, including my mom and my dad. Nobody. And yet, this is kind of fascinating. You've given me a family member that actually showed up differently before he died.
Edgar Gielsdorf wanted his children and grandchildren to know his story so they would never take freedom and democracy for granted. Without realizing it, Salama fulfilled his wish. With a master's degree in social justice, she worked in the field for 2 decades until a different calling drew her to train as a Buddhist chaplain, offering support to help ease the suffering of others.
My personal journey doesn't feel so personal anymore, and that it's not just about me. There's so much more that can be done, you know?
And for those who want to know more about their family history, she says, it's important that they explore it with a clear intent.
Maybe some kind of understanding within themselves what flavor their pain is, you know? Because if it's in your family, you carry it with you. If it's in your community, you carry it with you.
Back in Berlin, not far from Germany's biggest Holocaust memorial, is a prominent bookstore. The third floor has a history section with an entire wall devoted to the Nazi period. It can be argued that without truth-telling within families, a national reckoning can only go so far. But Salama Aliyah is by no means alone. Others in her generation and their children are asking questions too. For the world, this is Alexa Dvorsen in Berlin.
Transgender women have been banned from international track and field events. Sebastian Coe, the president of the sports governing body, World Athletics, made the announcement yesterday.
The World Athletics Council has today taken the decisive action to protect the female category in our sport.
The World's Bianca Hillier is following this story for us and here to explain what protect the female category means to the World Athletics Council. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Carol.
Now, I want to back up a bit. Why has World Athletics been looking into this in the first place?
So last year, the International Olympic Committee put out these blanket rules on trans athletes in elite competitions. And they said after extensive research, it is no longer clear that testosterone levels are the most important factor in determining whether trans women should be allowed to compete, and that new policies should be viewed with a human rights lens, not just a medical lens. But they left it up to individual sports to set their own rules. So these are the new rules for World Athletics. And to be clear, the ban is only aimed at trans women, not trans men, who are allowed to compete at elite levels.
Got it. And quickly remind us which sports World Athletics covers.
Yeah, it's going to be track and field, cross country, all road races, race walking, mountain running, and ultra running.
Okay, so did World Athletics give any insight on how they came to this decision to ban trans athletes?
Yeah, governing body President Coe says they consulted 40 member federations, coaches, athletes, and trans groups, and UN experts, to name a few.
The majority of those consulted stated that transgender athletes should not be competing in the female category.
Some athletes have praised this ruling for prioritizing what they call fairness, though World Athletics recognized that the decision is not based in evidence. The organization said there is no evidence of how trans women would impact the fairness of these competitions because, as Coe acknowledged, this move is a solution to a problem that currently doesn't exist.
There are no transgender athletes competing in international competition in athletics, and no observations therefore exist from the front line, in our case, the field of play.
Huh. So this currently impacts nobody.
Well, it will certainly deter trans women from working to go pro in track and field, and trans advocates are concerned about the trickle-down effect the ban will have on youth sports. And people have also argued that the ban does not protect the integrity of women's sports and only further polices women's bodies. But no, as of right now, the ban on trans women will not disqualify any current participants. Something else World Athletics announced, though, will impact current athletes, and that's further restrictions on athletes with naturally high levels of testosterone.
Explain that a bit. What are the new regulations on that front?
So athletes will now be asked to reduce their testosterone levels to below 2.5 nanomoles per liter. What you need to know about that number is that's half the amount of the previously allowed levels. So it's a significant drop. And before, athletes only had to reduce their testosterone levels if they competed in races between 400 meters and 1 mile long. And now these restrictions apply to all events. So this is going to impact athletes states like South Africa's Caster Semenya and Burundi's Francine Niyonsaba. They were both banned from the 800-meter race, so they moved up to the 5K, but now they're effectively banned from all events unless they take medicine to suppress their testosterone levels.
And are these new rules in line with other international policies? I mean, what are other sports doing?
Yeah, they're not unprecedented rules. In 2020, World Rugby became the first international sports federation to ban trans women at the elite level. And World Aquatics, which governs all water sports, voted last June to ban trans women from elite competition if they had experienced any part of male puberty. So there's a trend well underway here.
So I'm wondering, Bianca, what options does this leave for trans women to compete at elite and international levels?
There's really no viable options for trans women to compete right now. When World Aquatics announced their ban last year, they did propose this third open competition category and assigned a working group to look into it. And World Athletics President Sebastian Coe said they also discussed this option, but ultimately decided against it for unspecified reasons. And trans athletes I've spoken with, though, say this option wouldn't work on a logistics level, as there may not be enough people in a local area to make a team, let alone, you know, have other teams to compete against. So there would still be a lot of details to work out in that case.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports and LGBTQ news for us. She's been filling us in on the global track and field governing body banning transgender women from competitions. Bianca, thanks for this update.
Thank you, Carol.
In Miami, the largest immigrant communities are Haitian and Cuban. Brazilians are only slightly more than 2% of Miami's population. The city, though, remains one of the key destinations for Brazilian expats in the U.S. Culture naturally follows. For example, the 11-piece Brazilian big band, Gafieira Rio Miami.
Sou é madeira, meu peito é do povo, do samba e da gente. E dou meu recado de coração quente. Não ligo a tristeza, não, por eu sou gente.
With local Brazilian talent like Isa Duarte on vocals, the ensemble immerses you in the 1960s and 70s energy of samba when it became the pop currency in Brazil. Gafieira Rio Miami was formed just a couple years ago by Grammy-winning bassist Diogo Brown, who, truth in advertising, is from Rio de Janeiro. The word Gafieira roughly translates as honky-tonk and refers to old-school cabaret in Brazil, a dance venue where the common folk would go. It's since evolved into samba partner dancing and samba ballroom. Gafieira Rio Miami, though, is about high and low culture, keeping the dance floor open to as many comers as possible. That's also the makeup of the band itself, Brazilians, but also musicians with Hispanic and American backgrounds. The big band has just released its first video to accompany this track, a classic number by the great sambista João Nogueira titled Nona Madeira, or A Knot in the Wood. Taking you into the weekend, up-tempo. New music there from Gafieira Rio Miami. As if we needed it, even more evidence that Miami just may be the capital of Latin America. We've got a link to that video on our Twitter. We are at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Online at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being here.